Oh, I guess I shouldn't do that when the mic is open. Let me get my throat spray out here. Here we go. Three shots. Inhale. And swallow. Soothing throat spray. The process of getting it down the gullet ain't so smooth, though. It's 3 p.m. Pacific daylight time. I have to keep reminding myself whether this is daylight savings or not. I guess it is. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. 101.3 FM on your dial. And streaming live at freakradio.org. Hi, I'm Ren, and this is the Mideast Madness Show, coming to you every Monday at 1500 hours, 3 p.m., here on the west coast of North America. This show is for Monday, May 6, 2013. If you're listening to a rerun, never forget that you can call into the show when I'm doing it live at 3 p.m. on Mondays. But when you're listening to a rerun or a replay, a refeed, as they call it, you can't really call in. Not to me, anyway, unless I happen to be in the studio. Yes, this is Mideast Madness. And I'm going to talk at you a little more than usual here, because I always want to give people the best idea of where I'm coming from. Again, my name is Ren Tawil. I was born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. However, my father was born and raised in the Jerusalem-Palestine area. He was born in Jerusalem. He was a Christian Arab. I actually grew up in the Lutheran Church, the tradition which he brought over. Yes, there are Lutherans and Methodists and all the other Protestants, as well as the various Catholic and Orthodox Catholic churches present in Jerusalem. They're still there. Even in 1915, the year of my father's birth, they were there, all participating in Jerusalem. Some longer than others, but there was already a myriad of religions and ethnic groups in Jerusalem and throughout Palestine. Of course, it had been for some 400 years under Ottoman or Turkish rule, but these various peoples were still there, and they persisted, as most or all of them persist now. Their numbers may have been reduced or increased, but they are still present. Now, before I get too far off track, the important thing is my father happened to be out of that country, out of his native country of Palestine, in the U.S. of A., doing some family business, taking care of some economic business. He and his brother owned and managed two hardware stores, one in Jerusalem and one in Haifa. He was here on May 14th, 1948, fully expecting to return home, although aware that there had been a quasi-civil war going on in Palestine for over 6 months before May 14th. Now, on that particular date, the Zionist partisans, the pre-Israeli authorities, declared Israel to be a free and independent state after having undergone some forcible military and bloody expansion into Arab state territory. That was supposed to have been for the Palestinians. Israel suddenly coming into existence left my dad in a kind of lurch because they canceled his British-issued passport because Great Britain had been in charge of Palestine from about 1920 until the 14th of May, 48. And Israel forbade my father from returning. He couldn't go back to his family or to his property, his businesses, never saw his brother again. Indeed, his brother, my Uncle Wadia, still remaining in Palestine, according to the family history, he tried to enter a warehouse that he had in Jerusalem in order to claim his property and perhaps move it. And the Israelis shot him to death while he did that. It's my uncle, my father's brother, his business partner. My dad also lost a cousin who had a farm in what is most commonly referred to as Palestine or the West Bank, present-day Palestine. And he refused to leave his home, and the pre-Israelis, militant Zionist partisans, beat him to death with their rifle butts. Eventually, the rest of my father's large family, some 9 children, as I recall, and his mother, who remained alive, left Palestine, some by way of Lebanon, but they all eventually came to North America. And I believe at least one went to South America, to Chile, to work in the mines. My father, having only the wealth that he had on his person, was forced to make a life elsewhere. So as a de facto exiled refugee of sorts, he established himself in the U.S. of A., met and married my white mother of Central and Western European extraction, and they had 4 children, my 3 sisters and I. Lucky me. Now, those are the facts that I've stated several times doing this show. And again, this is the Mideast Madness Show, coming to you live this Monday, May 6th, on Free Radio Santa Cruz. As I've declared also a number of times on previous shows, I do not want this show to be just another opportunity to dish out propaganda, pro-Arab propaganda, anti-Israeli propaganda. And it is absolutely by no means intended to be anti-Semitic. I subscribe 110% to the notion, to the fact, that being an anti-Zionist does not automatically make you a Jew hater. It does not automatically make you an anti-Semite. I honestly do not hate Jews. There are some gray areas here and there, but I deal with those as they come. The important thing is I recognize Zionism, which as an institution came into being in the last few years of the 1800s in Europe. A man named Theodor Herzl convened a congress in Basel, Switzerland, I believe, where he and other great Jewish minds institutionalized the effort to return any or all Jews from around the world to their geographic and historical homeland of Palestine, which in history has had a number of names: Canaan, the Levant, the land of the Philistines, the land of the Israelites. They would call this new 20th century nation Israel. And thus was the foundation of Zionism as we know it today. Zionism is a political philosophy. I do not know that Zionism is mandated by Jewish scripture. I think to many Jews, certainly to Zionists and Israeli Jews, that it is a given that Zionism is sanctioned by God to allow the Jews to, quote-unquote, redeem Eretz Israel, to return to and claim the land of Israel. Now, particularly since the end of World War II, when the horrors of the Holocaust in Europe were unveiled, sympathy slowly, perhaps in spurts, for the plight of the Jews in Europe, for those who perished, for those who lost family members, for those who went through hell perpetrated by the Nazis. Sympathy for those and a kind of automatic acceptance of the idea that maybe the Jews should have a homeland. They've been persecuted throughout history, which they have. Not that Christians haven't, not that nobody else has ever experienced persecution, but the Jews in particular, they already have a plan for reclaiming land that was occupied by various empires, including the ancient Israelites. And in the previous millennia, 1901 to 2000, wait a minute, that can't be right. Not 1901, I'm sorry. 1001, yeah, this second millennium, 1001 to the year 2000. What was I going to say? In the second millennium, latter half of it, the Ottoman Empire ruled much of Arabia, including what is referred to by many as Palestine and by many as Israel today, for some 400 years. Then the Ottomans allied themselves with Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the beginning of World War I. As we know, the United States, Britain, and France primarily won the First World War. Germany lost, which meant the Austro-Hungarians lost, and the Turks lost. The Ottoman Turks lost, and their empire was radically reduced in size, and they lost the area of Palestine, including other areas of Arabia, which today are called by the names Syria, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, and perhaps Kuwait and portions of Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Great Britain, victor in the First World War, and France came to control these areas, and according to the treaties which followed the end of the First World War, those became colonial possessions. Mind you, European imperialistic colonial possessions of France and Great Britain. Britain, in particular, controlled Palestine, which initially, at the time, included present-day Jordan, the present-day Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, which was also called Transjordan, because it traversed the Jordan River. So, regardless of what you call the land, the name Palestine does go back a very, very long time. Some say the word Palestine is derived from Philistine, or the Philistines, the land where the Philistines lived. Philistine translates as people of the sea, and they're right on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea there. And the Philistines were the people who populated land that, according to Judaic tradition and Judaic scripture, was promised to them by God, the land of milk and honey, as it were, as the ancient Hebrew people, the Jews, exiled themselves from under the iron hand of Egypt's Pharaoh. And they came upon, the ancient Hebrews came upon these Philistines who lived in the land that supposedly God promised them. And according to their scripture, even Old Testament scripture, as is practiced in the Christian faith, as is recognized in the Christian faith, declared these Philistines to be, and I quote, a blight upon the land, end quote. In other words, it was okay for the Israelis to out them, to do whatever they needed to do to prepare the land as God promised them, so the scripture says, for their own people to populate and flourish in. So, even if you go back to this time, very roughly the year 1300 before the Common Era, or before Christ, B.C., there were people there even when the first ancient Israelites came there. So there is indeed a root connected with the name Palestine that goes back a very long time. True, there have been many strains of blood and chromosomes that have gotten mixed into the bag of the Palestinian population. But the name has remained. The British chose to call it Palestine. Seemed more appropriate, more universal, and more contemporarily, at that time, recognized as a common name for Palestine. The land of Palestine, historic Palestine. The Zionists, the people who saw things a different way, even starting from this conference in Switzerland in 1897. I think that was the year 97, 92, something like that. Began talking about shifts in the population that would probably have to occur in order to establish new Jewish homeland. In other words, even before the beginning of the 20th century, the Zionists began in earnest talking about a number of things, including the expulsion, one way or another, of Arabs outside of their land of Israel, their Eretz Israel. This was repeated going into the 20th century, in the 1920s and 1930s. There were interviews and works, written documents coming out and still available today, which repeated what they considered the necessity of transferring or expelling Arab populations from their desired homeland. In other words, for well over 100 years, the Zionists were planning ethnic cleansing. By no means the first time it would ever occur in history, but ethnic cleansing, call it that or any other name you want to, was in the works from the beginning of this new movement for a Jewish homeland. So I don't want to take up really any more time of this personal thing. I just want people to understand a couple of critical things. Namely, that I am not an anti-Semite. Indeed, I am an ardent non-Zionist / anti-Zionist, never to be mistaken for anti-Semitism. There are genuine anti-Semites, people who hate Jews to the nth degree, who will muck things up for the rest of us who are trying to pursue peace and justice in Palestine and Israel. They would like to, and some of them would like to include their numbers among our numbers, those who I just described to you as earnestly pursuing peace and justice. But it only makes for a bad soup when you when these bigots come in and try to include themselves into this ongoing struggle. That's the first thing. As an anti-Zionist, I am not an anti-Semite, even though I know some of you listening will ignore that, ignore the earnestness of what I'm saying and say, no, it's impossible. You can't be an anti-Zionist without being an anti-Semite. I simply don't agree with that philosophy. That's the first thing I want people to keep in mind. The second thing is, indeed, if people insist on framing me, viewing me, and perhaps even labeling or calling me a bigot or a Jew hater or an anti-Semite, you take a look at your own backyard. You look upon Zionism for what it is and what it was designed to be well over 100 years ago, with all its violent intentions, along with the seemingly beneficent intentions of saving the Jews, saving world Jewry. And you see the racism inherent in Zionism. When you talk about the genetic strains of the ancient Israelites, the ancient Jews, the lost 10 tribes, however you view those ancient peoples, and remind everyone that those genetic elements, those chromosomes, persisted in Palestine in what became a small minority around the 1890s, a minority in Palestine. And when you start claiming that this entitles Jews everywhere, from anywhere in the world, to repopulate the ancient homeland at the expense of native, dare I say, indigenous Palestinian Arabs, that's clearly racist. Because you're saying the chromosomes essentially are more important than the actual lives and bodies of living, acculturated Palestinian Arabs. They are indigenous. They are indeed indigenous. And this neo-indigenous identity that Zionist Jews have and that Israelis have does not and cannot vacate that identity of the Palestinians. They are indigenous Arabs. So I say again to Israelis, to Jews who support Israel or are wondering whether or not they should support Israel, to Zionists everywhere, look upon your own lot first before you begin going on witch hunts and crusades to dig out every last anti-Semite wherever you find them or think they are. Look upon your own inherent racism. The racism inherent in Zionism. Okay, I'm going to just, let me do something on the computer here. Hmm. I'm just checking the numbers of my audience to see who is still with me. Interesting. No, I'm not going to share that information with you. Not right now. But let us go to the readings for the day. Let's see, what do I want to start with first? This is the Mideast Madness show. Mideast Madness, coming to you every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org, broadcasting within the city of Santa Cruz, roughly at 101.3 on the FM dial. Okay, let us talk now about Israel's intervention in the Syrian civil war. The primary reason for which, supposedly, is to defend themselves from armaments and support for Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon. This piece comes from This is written by Gordian Levy, a long time and well known and highly controversial contributor to Haaretz magazine / newspaper. One of these days I'll find out exactly what they can call themselves. At any rate, it's from their online service. Gordian Levy, perhaps the leading Haaretz editorialist. Obviously a Jew with a name like Levy, an Israeli citizen. A friend by the name of Anushin Framke, on May the 2nd, forwarded this to me and includes the introductory statement, "Can always count on Gideon Levy." His name is Gideon Levy. "Can always count on Gideon Levy to tell it like it is. No wonder he isn't feeling any love in Israel these days." I told you he was controversial. Okay, Israel and its tattletale campaign against Syria and Iran. Haaretz, May 2nd, 2013. Gideon Levy. "The fair campaign calling upon Obama to stop to bomb Syria has one real goal in mind. It's not helping Syria's civilians. It's a strike on Iran. There was always one kid in the class who is known as a tattletale. They did this or that to him, and he would always rat them out. 'Teacher, this kid is making trouble in class,' he would say. 'Teacher, he cheated on the test. We didn't love him.' That kid is now the state of Israel. The state's behavior regarding the atrocities in Syria is being perceived as nothing more than an informer's campaign. Nobody knows what Israel wants to happen in Syria. Is it for Assad or against him? Is it for the rebels or against them? The main thing is that it tells on them and prods the teacher, the United States, to start dropping bombs already, whatever the target." That probably should read, "To start dropping bombs already, whatever the target." There we go. "During a short break from the National Fear Campaign regarding the Iranian nuclear program, Israel is now free for another fear campaign in face of serious chemical weapons." Like on the Iran issue, there is a danger, like with Iran, there is exaggeration. Like with the Iran issue, the get-on-board effort is complete, including not only politicians and generals, but also the media choir, which, as usual, is taken to this fear campaign with an excessive zest. There is nothing it loves more than a fear campaign worthy of the name. Just look how coverage of an update in the Arab Peace Initiative 2 days ago was downplayed with suspicion and coldness. Then contrast it with the pompous coverage of the dangerous Iranian kite that dared to fly through the skies over the Mediterranean Sea near Haifa and entered the airspace of a country that launches its planes almost daily into its neighbor's skies. The countries that border Syria have been enlisted into the impressive humanitarian effort to absorb hundreds of thousands of refugees, including Turkey, which is engaged in clashes with Syria and Jordan, a country bursting with refugee camps, but of course not Israel. The Golan Heights that was conquered from Syria would have been the correct place to absorb some small portion of these refugees. But this possibility wasn't even discussed here. Here, they only care about Jews. In the name of the Jews, we present to the world, and principally the United States, another plan of action. Before you is the incriminating evidence. Now get to work bombing. Again, this is an article appearing on Haaretz web service entitled Israel and its Tattletale Campaign Against Syria and Iran, written by Haaretz's own columnist Gideon Levy. Continuing with article, Israel knows chemical weapons well because of its own horrible enough arsenal. These are frightening weapons. But the Israel Fear Campaign doesn't address the immediate victims of Syria's chemical weapons, Syrians. About them, Israel doesn't care. Arabs killing Arabs, you know. Photos of the wounded with white foam dribbling out of their mouths are distributed only as propaganda and proof. Tens of thousands of Syrian civilians were killed by conventional weaponry, and Israel didn't make a peep. Only the possibility that someone would use chemical weapons has awakened Israel from its tranquility. Let's assume that the evidence offered by military intelligence is indeed proof. Why should the fact that the Assad regime used chemical weapons increase the risk that they will fall into, quote, irresponsible hands? And will bombing solve the problem, as Israel usually assumes? Of course, this bombing isn't supposed to be carried out by Israel, but by its subcontractor, the U.S. It will be called into action. Incited into intervening in the name of Israel's interests. The U.S. is trying to distance itself from another lethal intervention, but the Israeli boss wants it in there. The truth is, this is just a pilot run. Israel is prodding U.S. President Barack Obama, catching him in his use of the words red line, challenging and provoking him to reach the real thing, bombing Iran. Israel wants to reveal the president's nakedness on the Syrian matter in order to present him as naked on the Iranian issue. Perhaps he won't bomb Syria as Israel requested. The key thing is that he should bomb Iran. This policy of manipulating the American president at the expense of Syrians' blood perhaps will pan out in the short run, but it will also make Israel even more loathed in Washington. Do not be concerned, I haven't left you. I am engaging in a delicious diet beverage.
Oh, I needed that. Yes, sirree.
Diet Cola. But it will also make Israel even more loathed in Washington. Of course, what occurs a half hour's drive from the Israeli town of Katzrin in the Golan Heights should worry Israel. Regarding the provision of aid, Israel can't do much. Perhaps it's even a good thing that Israel doesn't know what it wants to happen in Syria, so it won't meddle in affairs there. It's also permitted, of course, to call upon the world to intervene, but in the name of the something else, not for the purpose of manipulations and tattletelling. End of dispatch. Again, this was from Haaretz, dated May 2nd of this year. So, Mr. Levy seems to count heavily on the notion that those in power in Israel are mucking the distinctions between somebody bombing Syria and wanting that somebody to bomb Iran. I'm still a bit hazy on the connection he's making, but certainly Mr. Levy feels strongly that it is there. Okay. The time is 3:36 p.m. on the west coast of California. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. And this is the Mideast Madness Show. I'm Ren. Let me give you the phone numbers. So, if anyone is dying to break the monotony of my monotonous voice, please give me a call. Both of these phone lines go directly to the studio where I'm sitting here all alone. We don't want too much power at one microphone coming from one seated DJ or commentator. Here are the phone lines. Area code 831. And for those outside the United States, don't forget to begin dialing with the number 1. The U.S. and Canada's international access code. So we've got 1-831. The first line is 427-3772. That's 427-3772. Line 2, presuming it's ever really needed, but I'm sure it works as well, is again 831-469-3119. That's 469-3119. Let's get these lights ablazing and these ringers a-ringing. Arab Peace Initiative puts pressure on Bibi. Bibi is the beloved, or perhaps by some reviled nickname, of Benjamin Netanyahu, the current Prime Minister of Israel and leader of the ultra-conservative Likud party. Arab Peace Initiative puts pressure on Bibi, from a friend Daryl here, forwarded by him to me and others on a common email list. This news suggests a serious push by the U.S. to get Israel to the negotiating table, with the Arab Peace Initiative on the table. This is an important move. From the CMEP Bulletin, May 3rd of this year, CMEP stands for Churches for Middle East Peace, a coalition of 24 national church denominations and organizations, including Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant traditions. It works to encourage U.S. government policies that actively promote a just, lasting, and comprehensive resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, ensuring security, human rights, and religious freedom for all people of the region. Churches for Middle East Peace, CMEP, May 3rd. Arab Peace Initiative back on the table. United States Secretary of State John Kerry met with top Arab League officials in Washington on Monday to discuss the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative and the revival of the Moroccan peace process, an issue that Kerry has focused on intensely in his first months as the U.S.'s top diplomat. Following the meeting, Qatari Prime Minister and Chair of the Arab Peace Initiative follow-up committee, Hamad bin Jassim, said it was, quote, an important meeting, an important era, which we hope will lead to peace, a comprehensive peace between the Arabs and the Israelis, end quote. The biggest announcement stemming from the meeting was Jassim's announcement that the Arab League backed a solution based on the 1967 lines with, quote, comparable and mutual agreed minor swap of the land, end quote, which brings the Arab League in line with President Obama's 2011 proposal and shows a shift towards compromise. The original initiative does not concede to any, quote, land swaps that would allow Israel to keep some of its settlements built east of the Green Line in the West Bank. The Arab League proposal calls for, quote, a full Israeli withdrawal from all the territories occupied since 1967, including the Syrian Golan Heights, also pronounced Golan Heights, to the lines of June 4, 1967. End quote. A just solution to the Palestinian refugee problem in accordance with United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194 and the acceptance of an independent Palestinian state based on the 67 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. In return, the Arab countries affirm that they will, quote, consider the Arab-Israeli conflict ended, end quote, establish normal relations, and maintain a comprehensive peace with Israel. Secretary Kerry, John Kerry, embraced the announcement, telling reporters the following day, we're taking more steps. Yesterday was another step. And we're going to continue to march forward and try to bring people to the table, despite the difficulties and the disappointments of the past, end quote. When asked about the importance of the land swap announcement, he said, I don't think you can understand the significance of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Arab Emirates, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and others coming to the table and saying, we are prepared to make peace now in 2013, end semi-quote, end quote. I'm going to read that sentence again because I think I might have used the wrong word. I think I might have said understand when I meant to say underestimate. I don't think you can underestimate the significance of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Arab Emirates, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and others coming to the table saying we are prepared to make peace now in 2013. Can't underestimate them. Continuing with this piece, Chief Palestinian Negotiator Saeb Erekat responded to the Arab League comments by saying that they, quote, did not represent an opening for peace talks if Israel did not agree to a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders, end quote. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a chilly response to the proposal and in a meeting with Israeli foreign ministry officials said, the root of the conflict is not territorial. The Palestinian lack of will to recognize Israel as the national state of the Jewish people is the root of the conflict. A source told Haaretz, Netanyahu and his aides see the Arab League's declaration as a, quote, trick. That could determine opening terms for negotiations that would be bad for Israel. End quotation. Other sources tell Haaretz that Netanyahu is concerned about Secretary Kerry embracing the Arab Peace Initiative. He sent Justice Minister Tzipi Livni and Special Envoy Isaac Mulho to Washington on Thursday to meet with Kerry for just a few hours. Haaretz reports, according to a senior Israeli official, Livni and Mulho will use the meeting in Washington to try to gauge Kerry's position on the Arab League announcement and understand his plan concerning the renewal of talks between Israel and the Palestinians. The two will also present Kerry with Israel's reservations regarding the Arab League announcement. In the Knesset, 52 members of the opposition signed a petition calling for Netanyahu to adopt the Arab League's plan. 52 members signed it. If at least 40 members sign a petition for the Prime Minister to discuss any topic, he or she is required by law to do so. One member wrote to Netanyahu saying, after years of a diplomatic freeze with the Palestinian government, Israel does not have the privilege of remaining indifferent to the Arab League's initiative and avoid stretching out its hand to implement it while protecting Israeli interests, end quote. Netanyahu's reluctance to the plan should not come as a surprise. When President Obama announced in 2011 that the 1967 lines should be the basis for negotiations with land swaps, Netanyahu gave him a harsh lecture in front of cameras outside the Oval Office. But with support for the proposal mounting at home and abroad, can he afford to reject the plan without offering an alternative? A new subheading here. Actually, the way this particular dispatch from the CMEP, Churches for Middle East Peace Bulletin of May 3rd, these are a number of separate topics. We just discussed the Arab Peace Initiative being back on the table. Now we'll move on to violence in the West Bank and Gaza. This week has brought a rash of violence between West Bank Palestinians and Israeli settlers, sparked by the fatal stabbing of an Israeli settler by a Palestinian early on Tuesday morning. This was the first Israeli death in the West Bank since September 2011. The deceased settler, a 30-year-old father of five, Eviatar Borovsky, was killed near the Zatara checkpoint in Nablus in the West Bank while waiting for a bus. After the stabbing, Salam Zagal, the attacker, took Borovsky's gun and was wounded in an exchange of gunfire with a nearby border police force. He was then taken into custody for questioning. Police say Zagal had recently been released from an Israeli prison before he attacked Borovsky. A group of settlers from Yitzhar retaliated by setting fields on fire and throwing stones at two Palestinian school buses that were passing through. These attacks resulted in the injury of several students. A Palestinian Authority official also stated that masked settlers burned tires at road junctions in Nablus, hurled stones at Palestinian cars, and set fire to dozens of olive trees in several Nablus villages. Just checking to make sure that my cool edit program is recording this episode of Mideast Madness for posterity. Continuing. Late on Tuesday night, several settlers defaced several houses in the Palestinian village of Baitilu by painting the words, "Price Tag" on the walls. and broke windows. The Israeli Defense Force reports that Palestinians came out to confront the settlers, and violence broke out with a volley of rocks from both sides. The IDF responded with riot dispersal tactics on both groups. Israeli settlers also began construction on a new outpost, illegal under Israeli law, near the Zatara checkpoint on Thursday. The outpost was named Evitar after the murdered settler. Gershon Masika, head of Samaria Regional Council, a settler group, placed a large white tent at the site of the outpost and moved his office there for the 7-day mourning period. However, by 4 a.m. Friday, the IDF sent the civil administration and border police to destroy the outpost. Tuesday also included Israel's first fatal airstrike in Gaza since the November 2012 ceasefire. The Israeli aircraft hit a motorcycle, killing the driver and wounding the passenger. Witnesses have stated that the victim was 23-year-old Haitham al-Mishal, who Israel believes was a member of the armed group responsible for the rockets fired towards the southern city of Eilat last month. Let me go ahead and make comments on these, the last two items I read, regarding the violence between Israeli settlers and Palestinians. This is by no means the first time that Israelis have struck with overwhelming force, disproportionate force, the settlers I'm talking about now, against something like the single stabbing, the murder of an Israeli settler. Granted, this is a case where the actions of a Palestinian civilian under occupation committed a murder of an Israeli who is squatting on Palestinian land. In fact, for about 2 years now, there has been a marked increase, a terrible rash of instances of Israeli violence perpetrated on Palestinians, most of the time initiated or seriously blown out of proportion by the Israeli settlers. Again, we're talking about a stabbing death of an Israeli man who was waiting for a bus, and as a result, after this individual was wounded and taken prisoner by the Israeli police, settlers retaliated by setting fields on fire, throwing stones at two Palestinian school buses, attacks resulting in the injury of several students. A Palestinian official also stated that masked settlers, that usually mask themselves, I suppose mimicking the Palestinians masking their identity in attacks, burned tires at road junctions, hurled stones at Palestinian cars, and set fire to dozens of olive trees in several Nablus villages. I don't understand why anyone needs to go to such lengths to impress upon the fellow countrymen of the murderer that what he did was wrong. I see it as an excuse to continue to play havoc among the militarily occupied Palestinians in their own land, and particularly after doing something like setting fire to dozens of olive trees in several Nablus villages, using the opportunity to negate that property, that private property, and enclose upon it and expand more settlements. painting the words price tag on the walls of Palestinian homes. Settlers doing that. I guess that's their way of saying, indeed, as I was talking about, this is the price you pay for stabbing one of our people. And it really gets crazy, obviously. Israeli Defense Force saying that Palestinians came out to confront the settlers. Violence broke out with a volley of rocks from both sides, and the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, responded with riot dispersal tactics on both groups. I often hear about instances where the IDF is oppressing the Palestinians, stopping, arresting, and sometimes shooting and even killing children and others, other Palestinians who throw rocks. We hear about the IDF being instrumental in turning the other way when Jewish settlers, Zionist settlers, commit crimes against native Palestinian civilians and tacitly, in some cases not so tacitly, contributing to the expansion effort of Israeli settlements. Here's an instance where the IDF used riot dispersal tactics on both sides. It just gets really crazy. And again, the settlers, you know, they play upon instances that happen, as was described in the paragraph, which begins, Israeli settlers also began construction on a new outpost, illegal under Israeli law, by the way, also illegal under international law. The whole Israeli military occupation of Palestine is considered Israeli, is considered illegal by the United Nations and the Geneva Convention. New outpost near the Sitara checkpoint. But 2 or 3 days after the incident, the outpost was even named after the Jewish settler who was murdered. That's playing upon the incident within less than a week, a few days after the incident, the violence took place. They are building on the legacy of this man and his killing by establishing an outpost. Now, an outpost is a name which previously referred to, actually it still does refer to, an initial settlement, a founding, usually tent city or one or two wooden shack village, hamlet, if you will. A new one for Israeli settlers that has not yet been sanctioned by the Israel government, and which is working way ahead of any permits and red tape which has to be gone through for the Israeli government to sanction these settlements, which are illegal anyway. So an outpost is a super illegal Israeli settlement. Illegal on top of illegality. Gurgle, gurgle. So that's how that goes. As for the first item, the Arab Peace Initiative being back on the table, I read to you a couple of weeks ago, I believe, newspaper article from the Santa Cruz Sentinel, from Associated Press, no doubt, which reported afresh John Kerry's, Secretary of State John Kerry's engagement with the Israelis and with the Arab League, the Inter-Arab League, to discuss the 11-year-old Arab Peace Initiative, which, like so many other peace initiatives and efforts, have kind of been blown in the wind since that time. Or as the article says here, and the revival of the moribund peace process. Peace process gets a little bit of attention, sparks up slightly, and then something happens and it just goes away. And the rest of the world assumes freely, some of the rest of the world, that this is entirely exemplary of the way Arabs and Israelis are, but most likely Arabs. That they just can't make peace. That they're totally insincere. That they are, there are so many liars amongst their midst. That nothing is sincere. And no peace can possibly come. And so I read this initial announcement about John Kerry's initiative. And I pointed out at the time, well, what I just described to you, that, you know, this is just another example of the re-stirring of the peace process and its eventual disillusion. Personally, I feel in many instances that the disillusion is caused by deliberate sabotage or effective, in effect, sabotage by one side or the other of the process when some violence occurs or there is some arguing about land boundaries between Arabs and Israelis, which kind of puts a stain on the whole process, and the process goes away again for a while, for a few years. Okay, so here we have the Arab League proposal calling for a full Israeli withdrawal from all the territories occupied since 1967, including the Syrian Golan Heights, to the lines of June 4th, 1967. For all you kids out there, the third major war between Arabs and Israelis occurred in the first couple of weeks of June in 1967, most commonly called the Six-Day War, because in line with the pro-Israel propaganda, Six-Day War, the phrase has a tendency to celebrate Israel's efficient and masterful fighting and eventual victory of a war against Arabs. It only takes 6 days to destroy Arabs who supposedly were attacking Israel first, but as everyone who really knows about what's going on, Israel did indeed take the military initiative, and they struck. They called it, this terrible, infamous phrase, a preemptive strike, in order to save themselves, to prevent the massacre of their own people, for the sake of Israel to survive, the Israelis will tell you. Preemptive. It is true that the Arabs began massing troops on the borders, but based on the way Arabs have done things since before the birth of Israel even, such movement of troops often has more to do with making a statement or frightening the opposition. The heat from the previous 1957 war and the 1948 creation of Israel and disillusionment of Palestine, any hope of a Palestinian national homeland, the heat since those first two wars made it easy for Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, president of Egypt at the time, and the leaders of Jordan and Syria, to act boisterously. But they didn't invade. They piled up troops on the borders. Now, you may say no wonder Israel made a preemptive strike. It's perfectly fine. There's a couple of things about that. According to the Israeli so-called defense forces, or I call them the IOF, Israeli occupation forces, even Israeli offensive forces, their own intelligence reveals that in their estimation, Egypt wasn't really ready for a fight, for a real war, which I think says something else about why they massed their troops there, to frighten Israelis into bending on discussion on their position in discussions that have been going on in previous weeks over some major issues. Might not be the wisest thing to do, but Israeli intelligence assessment of Jordan and Syria was the same, that they're not really in a position to wage war against Israel. So the Israelis knew this, and they still struck first. The second thing is, as everybody knows, virtually immediately after the dust settled in the June 67 war, the civilian settlements began. The settling of Jewish civilians, Israeli civilians, in the Sinai Desert, the whole of which was captured by Israel, right up to the Suez Canal. All of the land, all the rest of the land west of the Jordan River was taken from the country of Jordan. Settlers moved in there. And the sliver of land taken from Syria, the Golan Heights, also eventually became filled with civilian settlers from Israel. Now, something people should keep in mind when we're talking about Israeli settlers, these traditionally and in fact are the settlements are populated by the most militant, the most zealous of Jewish Zionists. They consider themselves to be frontiersmen, the expanders of the Israeli frontier, populating the land of Israel, similar to how the United States declared its manifest destiny in pushing west and evicting and, if necessary, killing Native American Indians as we settled our western frontier all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Our justification was manifest destiny. Israel's justification is Zionism, the promise of Zionism. All at the expense of Palestinian Arabs. Now, yes, I'm still making comments about the last article from the Churches for Middle East Peace, May 3rd Bulletin. The Golan Heights, the Arab League proposal calling for return of all territories from Israel to the Palestinians since 1967, and the Golan Heights to Syria, which is stole, whereas the Israelis say liberated from Syria. Doesn't even make sense. They see that as a predecessory action for a just solution to the Palestinian Palestinian problem, quote unquote problem, as though the Palestinians are inherently a problem to begin with. And but they just said in the previous paragraph that the Arab League was backing away slightly from that aspect of the 2002 peace initiative. Does not concede any land swaps. Not to concede any land swaps that would allow Israel to keep some of its settlements built east of the Green Line in the West Bank. In other words, they want to see a return to the 67 borders, but they will, in fact, consider Israel hanging on to the settlements in exchange for land in current Israel. Folks, face it, I am a one-stater, and I have been for some years now. The two-state solution is dead. Netanyahu knows that it's dead. Certainly, Mr. Kerry is intelligent enough to know that it has as much a chance of being resurrected and made into reality as a snowball in hell. But they keep talking about a two-state solution. And I rather than anyone who is dealing directly with this in a position of power and leadership, rather than them really believing that this can happen, I think this is a terrible trick they're playing on their constituents in, here in the U.S. and Israel and amongst the Palestinians and around the world. This is just to give the impression that they're doing something. And because a two-state solution, quote-unquote, has had so much lip service paid to it for decades now, ever since 1967, that gives it a certain degree of credence among the common person. And so these leaders, as it were, leave the impression amongst their constituents that something is being done. Because Israel would never consider a one-state solution which involves the acceptance of what would surely be an Arab majority or a Palestinian majority, which is to say a majority of non-Jews in Israel/Palestine. Israel, you know, the part of this article that talks about Prime Minister Netanyahu giving a chilly response to the resurrection of the 2002 peace proposal. Here Netanyahu is saying the root of the conflict is not territorial. The Palestinian lack of will to recognize Israel as the national state of the Jewish people is the root of the conflict, as he puts it, as Netanyahu puts it. To Mr. Netanyahu and some of his buddies, they will continue to stand by this issue, the absolute necessity of defeated Palestinians who have been denied their homeland, their national entity for so long now, their refusal to recognize the character of Israel as being, quote-unquote, a Jewish national state. And he tosses aside, the Prime Minister tosses aside the idea that the conflict is territorial. It is indeed territorial. Everything has to do with who lives where and what the boundaries really are or should be. But Netanyahu's trying to take attention off of that root of the conflict, the territorial root, and insists that it centers around Arab refusal to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. If somebody out there wants to call me now or send me an email, I'll give you the address in a minute, and explain to me just what is the necessity of a Jewish state, as it were. Why is it important that there be a Jewish majority state, or as many still hope for, a Jewish-only state? I think their current legal process calls for a minimum of 70% of the population of Israel being Jewish. And the right to maintain that. I'm not sure how they would do that without killing or expelling more Arabs. What good does this do the Jewish people? Until a few years ago, there was no place on earth more dangerous to the lives of Jews than Israel. It was Israel where the greatest number of Jews were killed, were wounded. And, of course, the security fence slash wall that's gone up and utterly decimated the property and the land of the Palestinians in the West Bank in order to protect not only Israel but its illegal settlements, that wall has worked in terms of what Israeli propaganda keeps telling the world we need this wall in order to protect ourselves. And yes, it has almost completely eliminated suicide bombers and other incursions from the Palestinian side of their boundaries. Again, at the expense of Palestinians. If Israel would only recognize the inherent rights of Palestinians and of Arabs as human beings, whose rights are protected by the United Nations Charter and defined as humans who have a right to live, to exist, and to live free, if the Israelis would stop pretending that this all has to do with ensuring the survival of Israel, what they really mean is the survival of a Jewish, majority Jewish state, if they'd stop doing that and start making substantial improvements for the Palestinians who are under occupation, improvements for those on the ground, the phrase goes, situation on the ground, instead of putting all their real efforts and their machinery towards infrastructure and construction and expanding their settlements. This is total hypocrisy, and this is exactly what's gotten Israel into the trouble that it's in today, and it is precisely what the one thing that most definitely perpetrates, perpetuates the fighting in the Middle East. Let me give you those phone numbers again. It's 4:17 p.m. We've got a little over a half hour of program left. This is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM, streaming at freakradio.org. Phone numbers, area code 831-427-3772. And line 2 is 469-3119. Call me no matter what you have to say. Don't be shy. Don't be afraid. Call me even if you know me, whether or not you know me. Call me if you're a member of the family and you happen to be listening. Give us a long-distance call or a message units call, as they used to call them. Let me know you're out there. Let's hear a voice other than mine. Yeah, somebody call me and tell me that, explain the necessity of an all-Jewish state. I mean, to me, it's always the first thing Israelis will say most of the time as well. There are 22 Arab countries, 22, 23 Arab countries that are predominantly Arab and predominantly Islamic. And there are some 50, whatever, over 50 states around the world that are officially, legally considered to be Islamic states. So why can't there be one Jewish state? Well, exactly what good has it done the Jews since it turns the native society upside down, kills, results in the deaths of so many, many people, both Israeli and Arab, upsets things on a worldwide scale. You know, Israel, in its history, has at least four times, perhaps many more since I first picked up this statistic some decades ago, Israel has at least four times in its history brought the DEFCON level of the United States and the Soviet Union's nuclear defense capabilities to the penultimate level just before DEFCON 1, I guess it would be. Or was it DEFCON 4 or 5? The penultimate level just before nuclear conflict, before the dropping of the bombs and launching of the missiles. Nuclear tipped. I'm not familiar with, I don't know exactly what the international incidents were, but for example, most likely this is what happened in the beginning of the 67 war, in the spring of 67, since at the time the Soviet Union as it existed back then was staunchly supporting the Arabs, and the United States was staunchly supporting in military and in other terms Israel. That, you know, that situation has brought us to the precipice almost. Right to the horizon in terms of nuclear annihilation, because of how it gets, because of like the Cuban Missile Crisis, or the Caribbean Crisis, as the Russians called it, brought us so close because of brinksmanship. The brinksmanship of the leaders and the power elite who feel that they have to do this in order to stare down the opposition. Yeah, back to my comments. Is it likely the Palestinians or the Palestinian leadership, that the Palestinian Authority will recognize Israel as the national state of the Jewish people so long as they don't have their own Palestinian homeland, recognized national homeland, as long as they're not allowed to institute the right of return for refugees back into Palestine, if not into Israel itself, that cannot bring Palestinians in the Palestinian diaspora to live in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip. Israel prevents most of the movement of people into and out of Gaza, even though, generally speaking, the IDF does not take up positions inside Gaza, although they do cross the border and shoot and kill people all the time. That is a statement of fact. You just don't hear about it in the mainstream media. Israel continues to incur across the borders into Gaza, ostensibly to counter the missiles and mortars that some groups, including many splinter groups, apart from the Hamas government, fire into Israel, which they always do, in conjunction with a statement that this is a response to something the Israelis have done. Now, I'm just looking for the last paragraph I was talking about. Yeah, the Palestinians are just, everyone knows, that even Netanyahu knows, this is one of the things that make him, in my opinion, a really evil character. He talks about stuff that he understands perfectly well cannot happen without him bending a little more, and his government bending a little more to the rights of the Palestinian people. Dismissing the root of the conflict as territorial, saying it's not territorial, and that the main thing is that these oppressed people have to recognize the Jewish character of an Israeli national state. Okay, let's go down to this very bottom item of this dispatch. Read it quickly. CMEP is urging you to take action! Exclamation point, encourage Senator Kerry to support the Salesian Sisters and peace. The Salesian Sisters of the Cremeson Valley are going to lose most of their land and be surrounded on three sides by the Israeli separation wall, the thing I was talking about to you just now, unless you and I can persuade Senator John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, to intervene for peace. Join Churches for Middle East Peace by taking action to overturn this decision. One of the greatest reasons to come to the conference is to meet other advocates who work across the country to engage in making U.S. government engagement in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process better. They're kind of mixing issues here. They're talking that they want people to take action to protect the Catholic Salesian Sisters of the Kremisan Valley. Of course, they have an automatic link here if you are online. So there are more details. If you want details on this and think you might want to support or encourage Kerry to do this, if you go to the, the Churches for Middle East Peace Bulletin, CMEP Bulletin for May 3rd online, and click that link and you will get the appropriate details. And as you just heard, they're pushing a conference in Palestine, I believe, that CMEP is trying to get people to go to. I'll just read this whole thing here. Meet new people and reconnect with people you've met before. Be encouraged and be in fellowship in response to the gospel's call. The gospel's call to be one Christian community. That's interesting. Says so in the gospel. Register today to be part of the work for peace. I think, again, that has to do with their conference. Here it is. Travel with CMEP. Visiting with Israelis and Palestinians is essential to understanding how the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict undermines the lives and livelihoods of both peoples. And to being an advocate for an end to the violence and better futures for both people. If you have a call to be a peacemaker and a passion and love for the people of Israel and Palestine, CMEP invites you to join a peace journey this October. Again, appropriate link is in CMEP's bulletin for May 3rd, or inclusive of the May 3rd date. Yeah. Folks, you know, it's not just Palestinians who are suffering, but Israelis who are attacked and are killed and whose lives are interrupted, whether their presence in their particular piece of territory is considered legal or not by Israel or by the world community. Everyone is affected by the conflict over there. And there are, interestingly enough, there are organizations and projects and educational establishments that include the people and the children of Palestine and of Israel, that where you will find both of them side by side in carefully guided situations of community. There are Jewish children and there are Muslim and Christian children, Palestinians, who are in some cases being co-educated and learning to live with one another. By my estimation, these are projects most of the time not established by either government, but permitted by the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority, by NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who initiate these activities. And CMEP offers further reading. Israel's vacant foreign ministry represents Israel fairly well. This is kind of humorous and interesting. From the Daily Beast. When it became clear last December that he was about to be indicted on corruption charges, Avigdor Lieberman resigned as Israel's foreign minister. Prime Minister Netanyahu is essentially retaining the foreign minister for its former occupant, at least until the trial is completed. In the meantime, the foreign ministry stands bereft. Again, details under further reading in that CMEP bulletin. Here's another one. Israel evicts Palestinian villagers for army exercise by Reuters. Israeli soldiers evicted several hundred Bedouins. And there are tens of thousands of Bedouin Palestinians. evicted several hundred Bedouins from a village in the occupied West Bank on Monday after the army declared the area a live fire training zone. I guess the Beds don't have much choice in the matter. If they want to live, they'll have to leave. Next item, Israel has nothing to fear, quote-unquote, by Al Monitor. Daniel Abraham, founder of the Center for Middle East Peace, warns Ben Caspit that without an agreement with the Palestinians, Israel will find itself with a non-Jewish majority. Next item, Google, quote, recognizes Palestine, from Foreign Policy magazine, I believe. On Thursday, the Palestine News Network noticed that the internet giant Google has changed the tagline for the Palestinian edition of its search engine. Its search engine, google.ps, from the Palestinian territories to Palestine. What can I say but long live Palestine? And let me repeat this information about CMEP. Formed in 1984, Churches for Middle East Peace is a coalition of 24 national church denominations and organizations, including Catholic, Orthodox Catholic, and Protestant traditions. It works to encourage United States government policies that actively promote a just, lasting, and comprehensive resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, ensuring security, human rights, and religious freedom for all people of the region. How often we have heard such words. info@cmep.org. They're located at 110 Maryland Avenue Northeast, Suite 311, Washington, D.C. Okay. Brief musical break. And then we'll move. Then we'll move on to something else. right, now, a short musical interlude there. We only have 19 minutes left in the program, so here on Mideast Madness, I, Rentawheel, want to get into something that I've mentioned over and over again in previous programs. I'm just going to read it now. It's about 5 1/3 pages long. It does connect somewhat with things I've talked about on today's show. And this show is the Monday, May 6, 2013 episode of Mideast Madness. The show will be repeated, at least the first part of it, at about 6 o'clock local time, Pacific Daylight Time. And will be, probably this episode will be repeated over the next 12 to 24 hours and intermittently throughout the week on Free Radio Santa Cruz, either today's installment or previous installments. Also, you can go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the character 4, the number 4, ALL.net, radioforall.net. Just look up Mideast Madness and you can listen to any of those programs, those dated programs, a podcast of those programs. Download that and listen to reruns. Hopefully the title of any particular show will say enough about what you might be looking for. But again, this is from Writing Rights, that's W-R-I-T-I-N-G, Writing Rights, the Center for Law and Social Justice, Zev Jabotinsky's The Iron Wall, published in the South African Jewish Herald, 26 November 1937. Barely a quarter of an hour left in the show. I'm going to zip through this. This entry was posted by Zaki Ahmet on June the 14th, 2010. It is filed as uncategorized. Again, Zev Jabotinsky's The Iron Wall from the South African Jewish Herald, 26 November 1937. South Africa now. For years now, a debate has raged whether Israel has a colonial state. I'm sorry. For years now, a debate has raged whether Israel is a colonial state. Zeb Jabotinsky was one of the leaders of the Zionist movement. Although disguised with liberal jargon about equality, his article, The Iron Wall, expresses sentiments that are colonial, militarist, and racist. I believe that Jabotinsky's article continues to form the basis of Israel's policies to this day. Avi Shlaim's book, The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World, published 2001, expounds that view. It was one of the most important books that I read and alerted me to the Jabotinsky article. Again, this is as Zaki Ahmet providing the preface to Jabotinsky's work. Jabotinsky raised funds in South Africa during the 1930s for the revisionist movement. In the 1940s, the revisionist movement included people such as Menachem Begin, who was the leader of the Irgun, a terrorist group. In 1948, Irgun massacred unarmed Palestinian villagers at Deir Yassin as a part of its ethnic cleansing operations in 1948. Hannah Arendt, the Jewish philosopher, called Menachem Begin a fascist and terrorist when he tried to raise funds for his Herut and later Likud party in the United States. Today, Likud is led by Benjamin Netanyahu. They follow the philosophy of Zev Jabotinsky. The South African Jewish leader, Jewish community leaders and its official organizations often send money to Likud for its election campaigns. In the 1970s and 80s, they contributed very significantly to a party that is racist and refuses to recognize the right of the Palestinian people to independence and statehood. The 1999 Likud Charter declares the Jewish communities in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza are the realization of Zionist values. Settlement of the land is a clear expression of the unassailable right of the Jewish people to the land of Israel and constitutes an important asset in the defense of the vital interests of the State of Israel. The Likud will continue to strengthen and develop these communities and will prevent their uprooting, end quote. Side note, Judea and Samaria are the Zionist / Jewish names of the West Bank. West Bank obviously is a somewhat geographic, generic expression. I'm sure the Arabs have their own regional names for portions of the West Bank, which simply have never become popular because they weren't pushed by the American Jewish community as well as the Israeli Jewish community as Judea and Samaria. And Gaza, don't forget. That's part of the 1999 Likud Charter. The leaders of the Jewish community in South Africa who believe in freedom, equality, and peace in Palestine, Israel, South Africa, and everywhere must distance themselves from their colonial past. This essay and the Avi Shlaim book is a must-read for every person interested in freedom and democracy in the Middle East. Jackie Ahmed. It's 4:42 Pacific Daylight Time. Here we go. Originally published in Russian under the title O Zheleznoy Steny in Razvnit, 4 November 1923. The English tradition in the Jewish Herald of South Africa, 26 November 1937. So the article actually dates back to 4 years earlier, 1923. The Iron Wall by Vladimir Jabotinsky. Colonization of Palestine. Agreement with Arabs impossible at present. Zionism must go forward. It is an excellent rule to begin an article with the most important point, but this time I find it necessary to begin with an introduction, moreover, with a personal introduction. I am reputed to be an enemy of the Arabs, who wants to have them ejected from Palestine and so forth. It is not true, says Jabotinsky. Emotionally, my attitude to the Arabs is the same as to all other nations, polite indifference. Politically, my attitude is determined by two principles. First of all, I consider it utterly impossible to eject the Arabs from Palestine. There will always be two nations in Palestine, which is good enough for me, provided the Jews become the majority. And secondly, I belong to the group that once drew up the Helsingfors program, the program of national rights for all nationalities living in the same state. In drawing up that program, we had in mind not only the Jews, but all nations everywhere, and its basis is equality of rights. I am prepared to take an oath binding ourselves and our descendants that we shall never do anything contrary to the principle of equal rights and that we shall never try to eject anyone. This seems to me a fairly peaceful credo. But, Jabotinsky writes, it is quite another question whether it is always possible to realize a peaceful aim by peaceful means. For the answer to this question does not depend on our attitude to the Arabs, but entirely on the attitude of the Arabs to us and to Zionism. Now, after this introduction, we may proceed to the subject. Voluntary agreement not possible. There can be no voluntary agreement between ourselves and the Palestine Arabs, not now nor in the prospective future. I say this with such conviction not because I want to hurt the moderate Zionists. I do not believe that they will be hurt. Except for those who were born blind, they realized long ago that it is utterly impossible to obtain the voluntary consent of the Palestine Arabs for converting, quote, Palestine from an Arab country into a country with a Jewish majority. My readers have a general idea of the history of colonization in other countries. I suggest that they consider all the precedents with which they are acquainted and see whether There is one solitary instance of any colonization being carried on with the consent of the native population. There is no such precedent. The native population, civilized or uncivilized, have always stubbornly resisted the colonists, irrespective of whether they were civilized or savage. And it made no difference whatever whether the colonists behaved decently or not. The companions of Cortes and Pizarro, or, as some people will remind us, our own ancestors under Joshua Ben Nun, behaved like brigands. But the Pilgrim Fathers, the first real pioneers of North America, were people of the highest morality who did not want to do harm to anyone, least of all to the Red Indians. And they honestly believed that there was room enough in the prairies both for the pale face and the redskin. Yet the native population of Indians fought with the same ferocity against the good colonist as against the bad. Every native population, civilized or not, regards its land as its national home, of which it is the sole master, and it wants to retain that mastery always. It will refuse to admit not only new masters, but even new partners or collaborators. Arabs, not fools. This is equally true of the Arabs. Our peacemongers are trying to persuade us that the Arabs are either fools, whom we can deceive by masking our real aims, or that they are corrupt and can be bribed to abandon to us their claim to priority in Palestine in return for cultural and economic advantages. I repudiate this conception of the Palestinian Arabs. Culturally, they are 500 years behind us. They have neither our endurance nor our determination. But they are just as good psychologists as we are, and their minds have been sharpened like ours by centuries of fine-spun logomachy, or logomachy. I'll have to look that up. We may tell them whatever we like about the innocence of our aims, watering them down and sweetening them with honeyed words to make them palatable. But they know what we want as well as we know what they do not want. They feel at least the same instinctive jealous love for Palestine as the old Aztecs felt for ancient Mexico or the Sioux for their rolling prairies. Sioux being Europeanized name for the Dakota Indians, Dakota and Lakota, and I can't remember the other name now, three parties. To imagine, as our Arabophiles do, lovers of Arabs, that they will voluntarily consent to the realization of Zionism in return for the moral and material conveniences which the Jewish colonist brings with him as is a childish notion, which has at bottom a kind of contempt for the Arab people. It means that they despise the Arab race, which they regard as a corrupt mob that can be bought and sold and are willing to give up their fatherland for a good railway system. All natives resist colonists. There is no justification for such a belief. It may be that some individual Arabs take bribes, but that does not mean that the Arab people of Palestine as a whole will sell that fervent patriotism that they guard so jealously and which even the Papuans will never sell. Papuans as in from Papua New Guinea, present-day Papua New Guinea, in the East Indies, other side of the world. Every native population in the world resists colonists as long as it has the slightest hope of being able to rid itself of the danger of being colonized. That is what the Arabs in Palestine are doing, and what they will persist in doing as long as there remains a solitary spark of hope that they will be able to prevent the transformation of, quote, Palestine into the, quote, land of Israel. Five minutes left in this episode of Mideast Madness. Arab comprehension. Some of us have induced ourselves to believe that all the trouble is due to misunderstanding. The Arabs have not understood us, and that is the only reason why they resist us. If we can only make it clear to them how moderate our intentions really are, they will immediately extend to us their hand in friendship. This belief is utterly unfounded, and it has been exploded again and again. I shall recall only one instance of many. A few years ago, when the late Mr. Sokolov was on one of his periodic visits to Palestine, he addressed a meeting on this very question of the, quote, misunderstanding. He demonstrated lucidly and convincingly that the Arabs are terribly mistaken if they think that we have any desire to deprive them of their possessions or to drive them out of the country, or that we want to oppress them. We do not even ask for a Jewish government to hold the mandate of the League of Nations. One of the Arab papers, El Carmel, replied at the time in an editorial article, the purport of which was this, quote, "The Zionists are making a fuss about nothing. There is no misunderstanding. All that Mr. Sokolov says about the Zionist intentions is true, but the Arabs know that without him. Of course, the Zionists cannot now be thinking of driving the Arabs out of the country or oppressing them. Not do they contemplate a Jewish government." And that must be not that they contemplate Jewish government. "Quite obviously, they are now concerned with only one thing, that the Arabs should not hinder their immigration. The Zionists assure us that even immigration will be regulated strictly according to the economic needs of Palestine. The Arabs have never doubted that. It is a truism, for otherwise there can be no immigration," end quote. I shall stop here. We're about halfway through with this 1923 and then translated into English 1937 article by Zev Jabotinsky, a major figure in the Zionist movement. So far, he appears to be approaching the topic with a great deal of thought and civility and some soothing words for the native Arab Palestinians. He even uses the word Palestine quite a bit. However, we've already come across of items which history has proven to the contrary, that Arabs have been kicked off their land, made into refugees, massacred, and killed piecemeal in some instances to set a terrifying example for others to pick up and leave. That is what, in fact, happened in 1948. There was also a very bloody Arab revolt, which lasted from 1936 to 39, eventually crushed by the British Palestine Mandate Authority, and pretty much eliminated the leadership, those individuals in leadership of an effort to establish a state of Palestine, the national country of Palestine, just as there became an Iraq and a Jordan and a Syria and a Lebanon, etc. Even an independent Egypt. I shall continue with the Jabotinsky article of 1923 next week. Mideast Madness at gmx.com is the email address for your comments, your one-way comments. If you don't want me to respond, then please tell me don't bother. But you may indeed email me at MideastMadness@G as in gorgeous, M as in Machiavellian, X as in X, .com. This is Mideast Madness show for May 6, 2013. Archive available at radioforall.net. Thank you, as ever, for listening, for hearing what I have to say about this topic. You'll hear from me again next week. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, now Palestine Today.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, May 6, 2013.